Hello, hello, and welcome to Arthouse Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make arthouse, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Sweatman, and today on the show, we're starting a new series looking at the films of Darren Aronofsky. We're planning to talk about all eight of Aronofsky's feature films, starting today with Pi from 1998 and The Fountain from 2006. Joining me for this series is filmmaker and friend of the show, Michael J. Darty. Stick around. Welcome to Arthouse Garage. We recently did a series on the show going through some of the films of Terrence Malick with the help of my friend Bethany Worden. Go back and check those out if you haven't, but today we're starting a new filmmaker series. My friend Michael Darty heard the Malick episodes and contacted me about doing something similar for one of his very favorite filmmakers, Darren Aronofsky. And so we are. After discussing which films to do, we decided, why not do all of them? Aronofsky has directed eight narrative features, and we're going to look at two at a time. These Aronofsky episodes won't necessarily be all in a row, and in fact, I have some other films planned for the next few episodes, so we're going to spread it out a bit. We also aren't going to strictly go in chronological order through the films. We'll talk in a minute about the order and the pairings we chose. In this episode, we're starting with his first film, Pi, from 1998, and his third feature, The Fountain, from 2006. Michael calls this pairing the Order and Chaos films. Both of these were first viewings for me. Pi tells the story of a mathematician who sees everything in the world in terms of numbers, and he discovers a particular number that seems to hold the key to the meaning of life, or is he possibly losing his mind? The film is shot in a stark black and white, and it's one that has really stuck with me. The Fountain is very ambitious, following three connected timelines. It stars Hugh Jackman and Rachel Weisz. Jackman plays Thomas, a scientist who is trying to find a cure for cancer in time to save his wife Isabel, played by Weisz. It's a bit of a mind-bender, and it also has a very particular visual style, which we'll talk about in detail in just a moment. We are going to talk spoilers for both films, so don't listen to this unless you want to be spoiled. I do recommend both films. They are definitely worth your time, so go watch them and then come back and listen. Michael J. Darty has been on the show a few times before. He's a filmmaker and a disability advocate. He helped start the LA chapter of the Real Abilities Film Festival, and now he works for a company called Memory Well, where he writes life stories for hospice patients. What an interesting job. That is enough introduction for now. Let's get into our series on the films of Darren Aronofsky, starting with Pi and The Fountain.
"12:45. Restate my assumptions. 1. Mathematics is the language of nature. 2. Everything around us can be represented and understood through numbers. 3. If you graph the numbers of any system, patterns emerge. Therefore, there are patterns everywhere in nature."
"Do you hear Kabbalah? Jewish mysticism.
Insomnia haunts him and he twists and turns in his bed.
Maybe that pattern is like the pattern in the stock market. The Torah. This 216 number.
This is insanity, Max.
Or maybe it's genius. I have to get that number.
Hold on. You have to slow down. You're losing it.
You only gave us part of the code. Now give us the rest of the code so we can set it right.
You are only a vessel from our God. You are carrying a delivery that was meant for us."
"There will be no order, only chaos."
Welcome back to the podcast, Michael J. Darty. How are you today?
I'm good. Oh, you added the J this time.
I did. Yeah, I don't know.
J for Joseph.
It sounds a little more professional or something. I don't know.
Well, it was the name that was on my Writers Guild card.
Oh, nice.
Because there was already a Michael Darty with the same spelling. So I had to.
Really? Oh, interesting.
Add the J. Yeah.
Well, the last time you were here was for our Irish discussion of Banshees of Inisherin, which was wonderful. And
I guess we talked about, you reached out to me first because you had heard me talking about Terrence Malick with our mutual friend Bethany Worden, and said, hey, what if we did something like that for Aronofsky? I was like, that sounds great. And I said, let's just do three or four like I did with Terrence Malick. And you're like, well, we could do all of them. Like, all right, let's do it. So, because, you know, with the award season over, I do, you know, need some stuff to talk about. So I said, absolutely.
And he, like Malick, has a manageable enough
right
filmography where, and the interesting thing and what I pitched is that Aronofsky is one of the most like thematically pronounced filmmakers. Like they're all clearly about something, and so many of them are completely linked, whether he intended that or not. I mean, he really, whether or not you believe in the auteur theory, I mean, this is, he sort of embodies that very, very clearly.
Yeah, it's interesting. He's a filmmaker who I'm not a completist yet. I will be at the end of this. What I had seen before we started this was Black Swan, when that was in the theater, which I really liked. And then The Whale recently. And that was it. Like, I still have never seen Requiem for a Dream or The Pie or The Fountain, which I have now seen for today. Yeah, so some big blind spots are going to be filled in for me as well. So that was another reason to do it. And actually, so I was going to say, let's talk about Aronofsky first, but let's talk through the schedule because it's kind of interesting. I was like, well, would you want to go through chronologically? But then you said, oh, I have some thematic ties, which, you know, it reminds me of like, if you get some of the Criterion box sets, they have like, they're kind of paired in different ways. As if it's like a film festival watching through, they're not necessarily in chronological order. So let's talk through.
It's interesting because that's probably because I've been a film festival programmer and director before. That's probably where my brain was at. I was like, how is this gonna flow together? And I was so impressed with what you and Bethany did and how those movies sort of bounced off of one another. I said, I think this is even more obvious.
Yeah, and I think it's a really nice little through line that you've got for each of these. Yeah, I really enjoy programming these little podcast things. One day I'd love to program a film festival. That can be a bucket list goal. Well, yeah, let's talk about it. So I was like, oh, what kind of order do you think? And then you came back with a fully fledged, like, here we go. So let's talk through it. Do you want to take us through?
So for the first episode, we're going to do the Fountain and Pie under what I would call order and chaos, because there is this idea that Aaron, and that this runs up through a lot of his movies, not just these two, that there's this chaotic world that everyone is suffering in, but yet the characters are trying very, very hard to make sense of it and to bring order to it, even if there's no order there. It's the imposition of that the characters are constantly seeking. And I think that applies for things like Black Swan. It applies to Mother for sure. So that I thought would be a good jumping off point, because Pi was his first movie, and The Fountain is, I think, his most misunderstood. So from there, I thought, well, he's also has concerns about the degradation of the body and how physical suffering is often linked to spiritual suffering. And again, this is something that runs through almost everything that he's made. So, but I thought for week two, we could do the male side of suffering, in which we look at The Wrestler and The Whale. And then in the third week, we could do suffering from the female point of view, where we look at Requiem for a Dream and Black Swan. And finally, for the fourth week, and it's the one that I'm most curious about to see where it goes, because you and I have talked, and it's almost every, it's actually kind of our theme, where I come on to talk about movies, suffering, and spirituality, and I seem to be repeating that a lot. And so we're going to end with Noah and Mother, which is my personal favorite of all of his movies, to talk about spiritual suffering and his relationship to God and religion. I mean, Aronofsky claims and has done this since the beginning, said that he's an atheist, but he all of his movies are constantly wrestling with where does our relationship to God or lack thereof fit into our lives, into the larger universe. I mean, every single one of his movies is about this, or ends up like that in the end. And so I think it'll be a good way to sort of round back to where he started in terms of chaos and order and how that's connected to some sense of God.
That's
very so it's going to be really, really easy. It's going to be smooth. It's going to be happy.
I mean, that's probably why I haven't, taken the time for a Requiem for a Dream, because I've heard how, heavy it is and that sort of thing. But yeah, I'm excited to get into it. Interesting to hear that Mother is your favorite, because I know that one and probably Mother and the Fountain are the most critically
misunderstood ones. And yeah, those are my two favorites.
Well, I'm excited then. It's exactly the right. I realized as I'm doing this podcast, the best thing is to find someone who's a huge champion for that movie and have them on the show to talk about it. And so that's my favorite thing. So I'm excited to get into it. We've kind of touched on this already as you talk through this, but as far as Darren Aronofsky as a filmmaker, what would you say sets him apart among modern filmmakers or kind of historically too? What do you think of Aronofsky? Like, what are the big things that think this is an Aronofsky movie?
Well, okay, so Hit Pi came out when I was in film school, and so I discovered him right at the starter gun. And so he was sort of in that 90s class, where it's not quite Tarantino, because he was like the early 90s, but this was like Alexander Payne and David Fincher and Spike Jones, those kind of very idiosyncratic indie filmmakers. And here you have this kid who grew up in Coney Island, Brooklyn, and who was Harvard educated, and is a Jewish kid, and was making shorts, and then found a way to get funding for Pi, which I don't remember the exact budget, but it was a cheap, really micro budgeted film. And do you know the story of how he made it?
I've heard bits and pieces, but go ahead and recount it.
So Woody Allen was making his movie Celebrity in New York at the same time, and Aronofsky and his crew, to avoid the hassle of having to get permits for things, followed the Woody Allen production around and claimed that they were shooting second unit for him, because there were and nobody questioned it, because there were visibly Jewish characters in Aronofsky's movie. And so he basically made Pi around a Woody Allen movie.
That's amazing. Yeah, I knew there was something with Woody Allen, but I read it briefly, but didn't fully understand it. That's incredible. It's such a, I guess that's, are we ready to move into Pi and talk some more about this film? So what we're going to do is talk about each of these films today, Pi and The Fountain, and then we'll kind of tie things together thematically with The Order and Chaos, talking about both films at the end. And we are going to spoil both films. So if you haven't seen them, go back and watch them, but we're going to talk about the endings. Yeah, Pi. So just to give my brief reaction to it as my first time seeing it, such an experience and such a distinct kind of vision to it. It's interesting. Like, I think about, if I watched Pi and I watched The Whale, I wouldn't necessarily think, oh, that must be the same director, like stylistically, visually. And so as I, as we watch through these, maybe I will have a little bit more of a familiarity with like what he's doing with the camera, different things. But I mean, I haven't seen a lot of films that look like Pi, but I really enjoyed kind of the experience of that and kind of getting lost in that. And Yeah, it was. So just the visually, the cinematography and the set design of it all, it reminded me a little bit of like David Lynch a little bit. Some of the like Eraserhead came to mind a few times as I was watching it. But then just thematically, the where things go, again, getting to the spiritual side of things with those Jewish characters was unexpected, but I really liked it. What do you think of this film? Is this one of your favorites of his? I guess you've already said Fountain and Mother are your two of your favorites, but what do you think generally of Pi?
I love it. I should just say, just as a sort of blanket thing, Darren Aronofsky is one of my like all-time favorite filmmakers. I've loved every single thing that he's done. And what's so amazing about Pi is how he would grow as a filmmaker, but you could see that there was a personality and a voice that was coming out, not fully formed, but pretty well formed, that he would carry both of his thematic and his visual sort of motifs and obsessions through all of his work. But in particular, it's this idea that for Pi, what's so interesting is that you have someone who is ostensibly mentally ill or insane, and that's another theme that runs through a large swath of his work, who is trying to make sense of the world, and he's using math or science in order to do that. And I was never a math person. I was always a softer kind of English lit guy. yeah, but I was struck even back then, because it was 98. So I was at a school where I had a really great sort of spiritual religious experience, but then was in film school where I was miserable pretty much. And questioning a lot of things and my place and things, and whether I was crazy for the way that I was feeling and things like that. And then I see this movie, and it's like you find the thing that is for you, and it's like, oh, I feel seen by this. I feel understood, even though it's so dark and disturbing. Mm-hmm. It was like, I'm so glad that somebody made something like this movie, because it's this weird act of hope to be able to talk about the frustrations of being alive in the modern world and whether life has any sort of meaning or pattern to it, or whether it is entirely chaos. And if it is entirely chaos, how do we live in that world? I mean, the perfect example is the scene where they're playing Go, where Max and his mentor teacher Saul are playing Go, and Saul's interpretation of the game is that life is chaotic and we have to be able to live peacefully within that, whereas Max sees, no, I can see through the chaos, I can figure this out, and I can bring the universe down to size. I will crack the code on this. But of course, in the end, in so doing, he drives himself so crazy that he ends up hurting himself. Mm-hmm. And when I saw what he does to himself, I mean, it's one of the more shocking moments.
Yeah.
Especially because of the time when it came out. I mean, nothing shocking now, but seeing a guy self-lobotomize, it was a pretty intense thing, especially because I had brain surgery 10 times myself, so there was something that I could identify with. But it's that idea that you're just trying to rid yourself of your pain in the most visceral way possible, even though it's completely illogical. It makes perfect sense to that guy. And again, it's like, that's another, our relationship to suffering and what we do to ourselves and what we do to other people has been a thing that the whole way through has been sort of his thing. I love it from a thematic standpoint. I do love a good paranoid thriller, and especially because they really do seem to be after him. So it's like just because he's paranoid doesn't mean they're not after, like, that sort of thing. I love that. The quick editing, which he would become famous for, and especially in something like Requiem for a Dream, is incredible. And enough cannot be said about the impact of musical composition on the effect of a movie. And Clint Mansell's score for this is one of the most brilliant ever, and he's topped himself a bunch of times. But the relationship that he has to what Aronofsky is shooting and what he's saying, it's one of the great director composer relationships. I mean, we're talking like on the level of like Spielberg and John Williams, or like early Tim Burton and Danny Elfman, where, or Hitchcock and Bernard Herrmann, where it's, I can't separate the music of Darren Aronofsky's work, or Clint Mansell's work in Darren Aronofsky's work. They completely complement one another.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. The score is really great. Yeah. Yeah. That's great. I love the score of this. It feels very late 90s, but yeah, it does. It feels like it exactly sets the tone it needs to. And yeah, now I'm curious the next time I watch this to key into that even more. But yeah, I really liked it a lot. I like the ending. I mean, I love that so this recurring number keeps showing up, and he's got it in his brain and all that. And then the Jewish people are saying this number is like the secret of God. Like you have God in your brain, basically. And that, yeah, the idea that he's trying to bring order, and then what I read as, again, as a hopeful ending, as shocking as it is, it's now he's lost his ability to do math and all of that, but he has peace. And like, maybe that's the only way forward in the chaotic world. Maybe you have a different reading of the ending, and I'd love to hear it. And you kind of have already answered this too, but I was going to ask, like, how does this set us up for, you know, as his first film, for his stylistic and thematic trends? You mentioned the editing. Yeah, it's as I'm, again, not a completist yet, but pondering, it seems like thematically he's very tied from film to film, maybe more than other directors, because I think about, maybe I just have more of a visual take on filmmakers, but like, obviously, like Terrence Malick, for instance, has the same themes he repeats, comes back and back, repeats on and on, but I always think of him visually first, as like what we're gonna what the experience of like watching and taking in a film of his is like. Whereas I think for Aronofsky, at least at this point, I'm a kind of thematic first as far as what is holding his filmography together. But again, that may change as we go. But yeah, what do you think about the ending of Pi?
I agree. I think it is hopeful, but it's hopeful in a really kind of sick and twisted way, which is I mean, you hit the nail on the head. It's that he is now relieved of everything, but at the expense of having lost everything. And so, I mean, we've talked about Samuel Beckett and how he's my favorite writer, and this whole idea of being able to embrace nothingness. There is almost something ironically uplifting about the fact that this guy who is probably going to be murdered by one or more of these factions that were after him finally figured out a way to escape from that. But at the same time, I mean, how tragic that a person comes so close in their mind to understanding God in some way, and it drives them to violence. It's not a good thing. It's a rather despairing and angry and terrible thing, having to come to the realization that maybe there is no order to things, that you have to give up on that idea that Saul the teacher is in fact correct, that it is nothing but chaos, and it could be beautiful if we learn to live in that, but some of us are not built for it.
Yeah, it's interesting thinking about him as an atheist, but seemingly a very spiritual atheist, if that makes any sense. I think that, yeah, what you just expressed feels like an argument for atheism in a way, that, you know, trying to understand God is folly in some way. You know, it reminds me of too, is I thought about The Matrix a few times. Maybe it's because of the score. It reminds me of that. And it came out around that same time. But the ignorance is bliss moment in The Matrix, where, you know, he's happier just not knowing. I think it's different, but I did think about that as well. Another film, did you watch the film The Believer with Ryan Gosling? I talked about it on the podcast some months back.
Yes.
I thought about that as well, just because we have this kind of person who's torn between two factions in a way, and wrestling with Judaism in particular. But I love that here it's like, it's almost like religion versus capitalism, or the factions that are after him. And I think I like that aspect of the film as well.
But he doesn't, like, he never seems completely taken by either one of them. Yeah. Like, he lives in this hovel of an apartment. He's connected to religion, but he doesn't want to be a part of it necessarily. He's obsessed with this one idea about the math patterns. But what's so interesting about the math, and this again, this goes back to ideas about atheism and what may be quote unquote out there, is that math is sort of an interrogation or an investigation of the immaterial, because you can't see it literally, but we know for a fact that it's there. Like, we know that 2 + 2 = 4, and there's no way around that. And so it's the idea connecting to God that we have a certain understanding about our world and the people around us. But we have that because there must be something that's animating it, or that's absolute outside of it, that helps us sort of reflect and define that, if that makes any sense.
It does. Yeah. It's reminding me, I knew a young woman in college. Actually, I was graduated, living in the dorm as the dorm dad with my wife working there. Anyway, she loved math, was obsessed with math, and she had a poster on her wall of the Pythagorean theorem, and she just loved formulas and things like that. And we were like, you know, we talked to her about it because people thought that was weird that she'd have a math formula on her wall. She's like, when I think about, you know, this has been true forever, you know, hundreds of years ago, Pythagorean theorem was true, and now it's still true, and we can find order in that. She was like, that to me points me to God. And she was, you know, this is our Christian university, and this is like very much part of her spirituality. And so I always thought that was so interesting. And that's exactly the kind of things in his opening monologue in this film that he's saying, you know, everything around us can be explained by numbers. And, you know, these are sort of a constant. And so I think that's a really smart way into a story and into the script that, just a really compelling kind of basis for this, to explore this sort of thematic territory.
But it's also that the solving of the equations or the creation of the pattern underlines how sort of finite human understanding of the world actually is, because we know that Max boils everything down to, what is it, 160? How many
digits
in
that
numbers was the name of God?
Oh, in the film, you mean like that number that came, I think it was 200 and something, or 100 and, yeah, close to 200.
So it was like 162 or something like that. Which is those numbers will correlate to the name of God. And once Mm-hmm. Once we understand that, it'll unlock the mystery of the universe.
216, I've looked at it.
216. So I just mixed up the numbers. See, I told you I was no good at math. But it's the idea that, yeah, you can boil it down to 216 numbers on a page, but there's something infinite because of math being what it is by nature behind it. And that mystery is there, and it's completely unknowable. And that may be also what would lead someone to put a power drill to their skull, is if they found the answer and it just wasn't good enough. And that's a really tragic thing to have to wake up with. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And like the idea of pi is the perfect kind of example of that, because like we can never get to the end of it, right? Yeah. Well. Yeah, I really really liked pi. I'm so glad that I've seen it now, and yeah, it does feel like kind of a quintessential 90s viewing that I finally checked off, and really glad that I have. Shall we move on to The Fountain?
Sure.
A special tree grows hidden. The tree of life. They say whoever drinks of its sap will live forever.
Symbol of your pledge to find the elixir of immortality. You shall wear it when you find Eden. And when you return, I shall be your Eve. Is everything all right?
Everything's all right.
How's she doing?
She had a seizure.
Wait, I'm afraid.
It's been progress of work.
My conquistador, always conquering.
We tested the substance. There's hope.
Your wife needs you.
Death is a disease.
And it's a cure. And I will find it.
You pulled me through time.
Don't worry. We're almost there.
Our bodies are prisons for our souls.
I'm not afraid anymore, Tommy.
All flesh decays. Death turns all to ash. And thus, death frees every soul.
Together we will live forever.
Just to briefly go over the timeline. So Pi was 1998. We're then skipping over, if we're going to go chronologically, skipping Requiem for a Dream from 2000. I'll just read through these really quickly. The Fountain, 2006, we're about to talk about. Then 2008 was The Wrestler, 2010, Black Swan, 2014, Noah, 2017, Mother, and then 2022, The Whale. So we are jumping from 1998 to 2006 now to talk about The Fountain. And this is a film that I think someone, again, in college, it seems like a very, like, you know, the college dudes are going to go watch a movie together. Have you seen this crazy movie, The Fountain? That's kind of the first thing I ever heard about it, was like people talking about it like that. And finally watched it this week. And yeah, I think I also knew that this is one of his kind of more mixed critical response kind of films, misunderstood, as you said. I liked it though. I think I, you know, ranking is a stupid thing to do, but people do it anyway. I think I connected with Pi more, but I did like The Fountain, and I'm definitely curious to hear what you have to say about it. I thought we might talk about the style of it, because it is, and you were just telling me a few things before we started recording that I'd love to bring back up about how they created some of the sets, set designs and things, but it has a really kind of singular style in like the production design and the cinematography, even the color palette. It's very, there's a lot of yellows and oranges. It's probably one of the most orange films I've ever seen. Just a whole lot of orange, but it's also very kind of claustrophobic. The handful of sets that we're in, like his, you know, his OR where he's a surgeon, and their bedroom, like everything's fairly tight when he's in this cosmic world where he's with the tree. It's pretty, even though it's hugely large, it's also, we're in these, and the camera's very tight on the characters for most of it, which is true of Pi as well. A lot of close-ups, I think, and kind of claustrophobic feeling. Well, tell us, what do you think about like the visual or the kind of the feeling, the style of The Fountain?
I think it's extraordinary. And finding out that there's no CGI in it, that indeed the space scenes with the stars and the nebula swirling around were all done photographically with chemical reactions under a microscope, and then use as a plate. And they did use a little bit of CGI to composite to put, say, like the bubble ship against all of that. That is true. But it has this, and I would say the same thing about Pi, is that there's something very human about the technique, that you can almost feel fingerprints on the sets and on the props and the world of the movie, that it's very clear that human beings made this movie. It wasn't computers, which is thematically for this one really, really moving. And I agree. I love the color palette. Yellow, as far as color theory is concerned, is supposed to evoke anxiety. And you do feel that in terms of Tom's quest to save his wife and to get to the answer to all things in the end. But there's something, and I think one of the reasons that the movie tanked was, this is Aronofsky showing us his heart. And he never really did that again until The Whale, to a certain extent, where he's a bit of a cool filmmaker and very intellectual, but there's something very fleshy about the fountain and the need to for us to preserve our loved ones, to keep them alive as long as possible. And also, I mean, the environment is always a big thing with him. And so to keep that tree alive, and we are led to survive by eating of the bark and the sap. So I love that aspect of it. And then what was your original question?
Just like thoughts on the style of it, which
I there's another thing where, if you notice, there are motif with shapes, that it's literally in every single shot, where you have circles for the future, squares for the present, and triangles for the past, and they're constantly overlapping on one another. And of course, one of the big questions is what's real in the story, quote unquote, and what's fantastical, and is the third part, is that just a dream? And so it's got this metatextual sort of thing about it stylistically that I love, where they're all sort of playing off one another and echoing one another, so that you don't, I think there is a complete experience at the end. But I think this was a kind of befuddling to mm-hmm. a lot of people yeah. on the first bounce about what it all means and stuff like that. So,
yeah, no, that's another thing I was going to bring up is just that it doesn't spell out that, at least that futuristic setting. I thought at some point, is he going to fall asleep and have this dream? Because in the present, he is reading the book and that's taking him to the past. That's taking us to the past. But there's not a clear link to that sort of cosmic area as well, which I like that about it, that it's ambiguous in that way. But I was going to say, do you have any other thoughts about how do you think that fits in? Do you think this is in his head, or do you think this is somehow a dream or something?
I'm inclined to think that the bubble ship is the absolute reality, and that he's imagining the present as a memory that may or may not be true, and then within that is the fictional story about the history for it, but sort of trying to place himself in a story again that makes sense, that how this guy ended up in a bubble ship flying off to the far reaches of space to go crash into an exploding star, it that doesn't entirely make sense. But if you trust what he's thinking about mm-hmm. backwards, it kind of does. But it links to Pi in the sense that he's killing himself. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an uplifting, moving ending, but he's crashing right into oblivion. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. Did you see Claire Denis's High Life?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Sort of has that's a much darker movie, but that has a similar concern about what is the purpose of hurtling towards oblivion, and can we make sense out of that inevitability? And they both movies, both Pi and The Fountain, involve a kind of, you could argue, resignation on the one hand, or you could argue peace, that these guys have made their peace with the universe and are going into the arms of it.
Yeah, that's a good point. There's that horrific shot where he's kind of floating into it and then melts almost, and it's this weird moment of body horror suddenly, but at the same time it is that hopeful ending of sort of the inevitability of it. It's films about death, I think this is up there as far as the very human fear of death and thinking about all the different ways that affects us. I think it's a really strong example. Sort of, I've said it before on the podcast, if one day I teach a college course about death in the movies, then this could be a good one to throw in there, because I think that it's an interesting thematic thing there. I was remembering as you were saying, the cosmic section is, those backgrounds are from the chemical slides, just like what they look at under the microscope. I remember that's in the film, and so there's you see it for a moment, then it looks just like that, and it looks a lot like the star that she points out at that in that moment, which is the same star he's drifting towards as well. And I was thinking too, I think the color palette we talked about, I think one of the few times that is deviated from is when we're out in the snow at the funeral and then at the gravesite at the end. So it's like we finally reach death and then it's sapped of all its color. I think that's an interesting thing that he does there as well. I didn't notice the shapes. I as you said that, I was like, oh, I can picture in each of these times, those different shapes. But when you're talking about how crafted it feels, I thought too of like the, there's a throne room scene where he's going to see in the historic, in the past, he's going to see the queen. And there's like the, all these floating kind of lights. It's really beautiful. And, but yeah, it definitely feels like, a composed story.
And can I just about the lights. Another reason why I love this guy, it's like, I'm not going to go the Kubrick route just yet before all is said and done, but there's stuff in that movie that I'm like, how did anybody think that up? Mm-hmm. Like the way that the colors are arranged, the way that the lighting is, and how it's like in the office, how you'll have like lamps that are lighting different areas, but then mm-hmm. it's like one source light in the middle and then all these more. It's almost like he's graphically showing you the universe, but in a different, a different visual motif of it. And I was amazed at the level of sort of visual imagination and discipline to carrying that theme over and over and over and over again.
Yeah, it's intriguing. I'm thinking more and more about the tactile nature of like the production design, even like the manuscript that he has. It just feels very like designed in a way that is, you can almost feel it as you watch it. And I think that's true of a lot of just the film generally. Any other thoughts about the ending of this film?
I meeting Rachel Weisz in my own life was a little slice of heaven. So it was and it's the best hug that I've ever received from a celebrity, hands down, not even close. And so, I mean, she's perfect. She's absolutely perfect. So you understand just by her very casting, why this man would go to the ends of the earth, to try and save her. But it and this ties into Pi, is that what's amazing about the order and chaos thing as far as math and science is concerned is that perhaps the tragedy of both of the movies is not so much that they have an encounter with oblivion in the end, but that they were so preoccupied with the question of existence or life that they forget to live it. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly underlined when with Rachel Weisz trying to get him to go outside for the walk and him barking at her. But he's doing it for a noble reason, because he really does love her and he wants to save her. But he's so wrapped up in what is logical that he can't see that it's the illogical thing that makes, it's the confusion of love and life that makes life worth living.
Mm-hmm. And it thinks about like the phrase missing the forest for the trees, you know, and here we have a tree at the center of this story. I think that's a good maybe summation of that. You know, a moment I love as well is the at the funeral, at the sort of the graveside service, it's Ellen Barkin, I think, is the actor, and she's just giving this beautiful kind of eulogy and saying that we all kind of have this sense of like wanting to have, I can't remember exactly how she says it better in the film, but having done enough things or having lived a beautiful enough life before you die, and none of us get there, but actually Rachel Weisz's character did. And it's a beautiful thing to say at a funeral, but also just like a really, I think, poignant insight to, that it rings true, you know, that, you know, I want to have these certain things that I've done in my life and probably won't. You know, like that, the sadness of that, but also the beauty of like accepting that, which, you know, maybe that kind of ties into like with both Pi and the fountain, like hurtling towards oblivion. But if we can accept that, then maybe there's a way forward besides obsession.
And I go back to Samuel Beckett. It's like this idea that, yes, there's an encroaching silence, but there's value in screaming against it while you still can. Because it gives others the opportunity to hear that, and it's too late for these characters. But there's a lesson there about, if not hope, which I struggle with every day, if not flat out disavow, but having the courage to face the chaos and accept that there's something ineffable and immaterial out, but it's there. Something is there. I mean, we're given limits, but in order to have those limits, something had to create the limit to begin with. Couldn't just have come out of nowhere.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if I can put into words my reaction to that, other than I think that's a really well put. And yeah, thinking about like the mysterious number in pi, it's like, is there something more? There is, but it's so mysterious that we can't grasp it. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That's really interesting. Well, we've kind of already maybe done what we're going to do at the end as far as like tying these together with the order and chaos idea. Is there anything else you wanted to add as far as the way these two films kind of go together thematically?
Well, I just want to say one more thing about The Fountain,
yeah.
Which is that this was between Requiem and this was the longest that Darren Aronofsky went between movies. The second being between Mother and The Whale. And this is a guy who has kept to his vision of things the entire time. And he's never really compromised his vision of things. But this movie, The Fountain, was originally supposed to star Brad Pitt and Cate Blanchett in those roles, which I don't think the movie actually would have been nearly they're good, and especially Cate Blanchett, but I don't think that the same amount of warmth would have crept in without Hugh Jackman and Rachel Weisz. But when the other two dropped out, the budget shrunk, and he couldn't do a lot of the things that he wanted to do. So what ended up happening is he published The Fountain as a graphic novel.
I didn't know that.
Which you can get as a supplement if you want to see what the original sort of vision, which among other things, the Tom character is completely naked in the bubble the entire time. So that amount of Hugh Jackman's Jackman would have gotten the movie an X rating. So I don't know. We might be better off for how he had to compromise in that way, but I love how doggedly this filmmaker works to get exactly what he wants, and he doesn't seem to care whether you like him or not, and it's like you take the movies as they are, and so that's been sort of a benchmark for me in terms of inspiration. And so it's in tying the two together, I love movies that ask very big questions that can't possibly be answered. And in terms of order and chaos, I mean, that's the whole purpose of filmmaking is that we get to play some version of God in which we take the chaos of life and edit it down to a kind of order that is manageable and understandable.
And
there's one other thing I wanted to say about both of the movies is that what's and this is about life in general, I think, that isn't it amazing how intelligible the world is? Now, granted, there may not be anything with the numbers and the name of God and all that, and there may not be a way to get to the end of the universe and then get your wife back. But the fact that we have any understanding of anything in terms of existence, and that is manifest every single day in different forms, How remarkable is that?
Yeah. It's I had something I was going to say about it. It's gone from my brain. But yeah, that's a good point. I think about, I mean, there's a real kind of respect for, I mean, math and science in both of these films that I think is just like a really interesting way to come at a story. But yeah.
But we it's like we use what we know, what is intelligible, in order to propel us into that unknown. And hopefully we keep laying down the more groundwork to make things even more intelligible, but it's that pushing forward that matters.
Yeah, when you're talking about,
I love this filmmaker. I love him.
Yeah, it's funny. I was playing, oh, every movie we go through, I'll say, oh, what do you think about this film? Like, do you like this one? Obviously, I ignore that question. Them all a whole lot. I was thinking about another recent film that kind of deals with that, like filmmaking as bringing order, and that's The Fabelmans, the Spielberg film, which I liked a lot, and then I watched it the second time and liked it even more. And yeah, exactly that is dealt with in the film, and you know, he has to control it, his mother says when he's little, and I think that's, yeah, I can have the same exact idea that these two films are, is like having, yeah, just needing some sense of control. And yeah, it's interesting thinking about like people who, I don't know, this is like a weird tangent to get on, we don't need to get into it, but like there are certain people who obsess over these things, like Max and in Pi and Hugh Jackman in The Fountain. But then what about the people who have found that piece, like the Rachel Weisz character? What is it? Because I feel like I know those people in my life too, who seem like they have some sort of peace and aren't too worried about death. And some of them are people of faith and some of them aren't. And so it's, I don't know, interesting things to think about as we continue through this filmmaker's body of work.
Oh, I'm so excited.
So next time, we are doing Male Suffering. So we're going to talk about The Whale, which I'm going to rewatch, which that's another thing. I really like Black Swan, which is the first Aronofsky film I ever saw. I did not connect as much with The Whale. And I think maybe on a second viewing, I will more. And having some of these thematic ideas in my brain from his other films too, maybe I will more the second time.
I'll just say this as a sort of trailer for that. I like aspects of The Whale because I think it clearly connects to things that he's done. If this had been his first movie, or if it was just a different filmmaker, I think I would have a different opinion on it. So I'll just say that it's the one of his that I struggle with.
Interesting. Well, yeah, I'm excited to watch it again. And then The Wrestler, which is probably the film of his I know the least about, actually. So that'll be interesting to dive into. So that'll be for next time. I guess we can kind of wrap up episode one of Aronofsky. And thank you so much for inspiring this series and for walking through them with us. I'm excited to continue on.
Well, we'll continue on our way towards oblivion, you and I.
Yes.
We'll report back.
All right. That's a good place to end as any. Thanks so much, Michael. We'll talk to you next time.
Thanks, man.
Big thanks to Michael, who always brings so many great ideas when he comes on the show. I love hearing someone speak passionately about films they love. So I think this series is going to be really rewarding with Michael on board. Stay tuned. Next time on the show, we're talking about the film Suzume, which is the next anime film from director Makoto Shinkai, who previously directed Your Name and Weathering With You. Filmmaker and my childhood best friend, Dyer Bence, is returning to the show for that one. After that, I'm planning a discussion of the new Ari Aster film, Beau is Afraid. Aster previously directed Midsommar and Hereditary, so I'm very excited for that one. And with that, thank you so much for listening to Arthouse Garage. We have a few years worth of episodes now. You can hear all of those in your podcast app of choice. Our theme music is by composer Paul Hunefeld. Learn more at appallingproductions.com. If you want to support Arthouse Garage, become a patron over at patreon.com/arthousegarage or find a link in the show notes. You can also buy an Arthouse Garage t-shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. If you want to support us without spending any money, leave a rating or review in your podcast app, and that is hugely helpful. Stay in the loop about Arthouse Garage and the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter at arthousegarage.com/subscribe, or you can email me directly, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search at Arthouse Garage in all those places, or find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening. And until next time, keep it snob-free.